morning, Kansas City. Welcome to Free Market Underground, where every week we bring you all things boom and bust. My name is Chris Butler, portfolio manager for Butler Lands and Wagler. Capitalist Pigs, produced every week by Mr. Martell Love, and the show is sponsored by Butler Lands and Wagler. Since Martell is multitasking this morning, also preparing for the Chiefs broadcast, we're going to let him do just that. But good morning to you, Martell Love.
Good morning, Chris Butler. How are you today?
I am very good. Now you can get back to prepping for a
Thank you, sir. Very important game.
Yes.
Good to see you today.
Yeah, good to see you. Thank you. All right. Let's talk about what happened this week as it relates to the economy and investments. There's a great place to start, and that is the tax proposal and budget this week. I'd like to talk about that if I can for a few minutes. Specifically, I want to talk about SALT, or the deduction for state and local taxes paid. For those of you who don't mind or don't know, this is a part of the tax proposal to help kind of shore up the cut, anticipated cut in tax revenues. Right now, you can deduct, or all federal taxpayers are allowed to deduct the greater of their income or sales tax liabilities plus their property tax liabilities over a 10-year period. This deduction costs, they say cost, I don't like that, but they say it costs $1.8 trillion. In other words, it eliminates from tax revenue $1.8 trillion over a 10-year period. After mortgage interest and charitable giving deductions, this SALT is one of the largest tax expenditures in the tax code. Again, they say expenditure, not me. The reason Trump and his advisors want to do away with that deduction is that it would, quote unquote, pay for a pretty big chunk of the reduction in tax revenue. But there's another reason why this particular deduction is going away. It's a subsidy for people who live in high state income tax states. Look at it like this. If I make the same amount of money as Joe, who lives in New Jersey, shouldn't we pay the same federal income tax? I say yes. That means if Joe, who pays more to his state than I do in state income taxes, he'll actually pay less to the feds than I would. And you might be thinking, well, Joe does pay more state taxes than I do, so why shouldn't he get a break on his federal taxes? The fact that Joe lives in a state that chooses to offer its citizens more free stuff, or it can't operate as efficiently as my state, has absolutely no bearing on our tax obligations to the Fed, or it shouldn't. So if I pay more federal taxes than New Jersey Joe, it's because my state gives me less free stuff. Does that make sense? Or my reward for living in a more efficient state is that I pay more to the feds than Joe, who lives in a state that can't operate as efficiently as all other states, mine included. Does that make sense? Well, I don't think so, and neither does the Trump administration. Fairness is one reason this deduction is going away, or probably some of it is going to go away. There may be a meeting of the minds on this, and it may get bargained into some kind of palatable negotiation outcome. But as it stands today, the plan is to eliminate the deduction for state and local income taxes. But when we talk about taxes or tax cuts or tax policy, I'm reminded that we had a relatively weak government because of taxes, lack thereof, from 1789 to 1913, and that's when the 16th Amendment was passed. And the 16th Amendment, of course, is the amendment to the Constitution that makes income tax constitutional. Prior to that, it wasn't. The exception of those years between 1789 and 1913 was the Civil War, where we actually did have an income tax. But the Constitution in the 1860s forbade and income tax. They were limited to tariffs and excise taxes, actually, but Lincoln needed money to fight the war, so he instituted the nation's first income tax, which was, by the way, a flat 3% of net income over $600 a year. And that's, to put that in perspective, that $600 a year back in the 1860s is worth about $30,000 a year today. So didn't the Supreme Court rule that this income tax would be unconstitutional? You may very well be sensibly asking yourself that question. Well, the answer, of course, is no. It was sold, this income tax was sold as an excise tax, and the court upheld it, Supreme Court. And you know what? That really irritates me, because that was purely a political ruling. A beef I've always had with the Supreme Court is that the Constitution is a fairly short document written in language that's not too hard to understand, although the English is certainly dated. You do have to actually kind of think about some of the sentences in the Constitution. But for the most part, if you read the Constitution while you're reading a history of its writing, you can understand the law of the land in less than a day. That's how long it'll take you to read the Constitution for understanding. We don't need a very learned person to interpret the Constitution. It's not necessary, because it's so easy to understand. Literally, any group of 12 junior high school students can understand what our Constitution means. Any income tax is not an excise tax. 14-year-olds would get that, especially, as I said, if they had read a book that describes the history of the Constitution while they were reading the Constitution itself. If you're confused between what an excise tax is and what an income tax is, you shouldn't be on the nation's highest court. You should be in school, relearning English history and logic. You're actually probably a danger to society and yourself if, after reading the Constitution and anybody's history of the day, you can't tell the difference between these two taxes. But I digress. My point is this. Here's what the Constitution says. No capitation or other direct tax shall be laid unless in proportion to the census or enumeration herein before directed to be taken. So here's the problem with that as it relates to income taxes. Number one, there can be no tax more direct than an income tax. Therefore, a tax on income should have been ruled unconstitutional right out of hand. Eventually, in 1913, our muddle-headed leaders got together and decided to get that 16th Amendment into the Constitution. I don't think they really understood all of the evil that it's caused since. And second, did you hear that line? It says, no tax shall be laid unless in proportion to the census or enumeration herein before directed to be taken. That means that my obligation to the federal government should be no more and no less than the next guy's. Why? Well, as one scholar put it, it's because the founding fathers thought that in respect to the law, all citizens are to be considered equal as persons and should be taxed accordingly, equally. Their incomes and possessions have nothing to do with their legal status. A man who has honestly acquired a large amount of wealth or a large income, he's legally on par with the one less fortunate or less proficient. That dictum that all men are created free and equal held in the matter of taxes as it did in the matter of social stratification. In other words, the Constitution recognized no caste system. No one and no group could be singled out by the government for special degrees of confiscation or favor, for that matter. But the 16th Amendment changed all that, and absolutely no end of mischief has ensued. It might be mentioned that if you read historical accounts of that period leading up to the passage of the 16th Amendment, it is truly disgusting to read the class envy that was allowed to dictate the passage of this amendment. It's even more disgusting to lie to the fact that the founding fathers anticipated that and tried to eliminate it with the Constitution they wrote and approved, and lesser men and women amended that restraint against the worst of human nature. So keep in mind, the next time that you hear about our progressive tax system or tax brackets or the rich don't pay enough or blah, 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 we're still dealing with the social ramifications of that 16th Amendment. And it isn't, by the way, just affecting us today. it's affected a lot of policy that's transpired over the last, 104 years? I mean, you can't have, in fact, you can't have Social Security if you can't first tax people based on their income. Right. So a lot has transpired in the last 104 years that goes back to what was clearly a play on our emotions regarding envy. And as I said, I think that's probably one of the worst elements of human nature that was played upon to pass that amendment. So what we're getting this week, to tie it all up, is an attempt to make the tax code more fair. Boy, we got a long way to go to get back to what the founding fathers had in mind, though. A long way to go. We need to take a break right now. When we get back, we're going to talk about the stock market. Why not? Because this show is about all things boom and bust, and what a boom we saw in the latter part of the week. You're listening to Free Market Underground, all things boom and bust. KCMO Talk Radio 710 and 103.7 FM as well. Welcome back to Free Market Underground, where every week we talk about all things boom and bust. My name is Chris Butler, portfolio manager with Butler Lands and Wagler. Just talked about the tax code, changes to it, anticipated changes to it. Now we're going to talk a little bit about the stock market. And we talked about this last week, really. If central banks didn't print money, in other words, if we were on a gold standard, the stock market would have gained approximately nothing per year. One stock's advance would necessarily come at another stock's expense. If you're not printing money, the amount of money that's tied up in stocks is all there's going to be. So, to buy one stock, you must sell another. Hope that makes sense. Look at it in terms of the aggregate. One stock's advance has to come at another stock's expense if the money supply is locked. No more dollars are being printed. And you'd get that, by the way, with a gold standard, among others. I'm not somebody that insists upon a gold standard. I just insist upon some degree of discipline in money printing. The whole concept of a rising stock market is an economic illusion. And that's what I feel like the value I can provide, indeed it is the value I try to provide, and that is separating illusion from reality. We talked a little bit about it last week. We're going to continue talking about it because it applies to a lot of things. When we see a stock index rise consistently for a period of time, and we're really seeing nothing but our currency being devalued by the addition of new currency issued by global central banks. In other words, when the central bank in the U.S., the Fed, when they print money, the extra supply of money outstrips a fairly constant demand for dollars. And so the value of the dollar has to drop just like a loaf of bread would, or a car or a house. Anything priced in dollars must go up when you debase your currency, and that includes stocks. So new money must be injected into the system to get the entire market to go up. This has implications that we started to address last week, but those implications are for both investors and non-investors alike. This week, on Thursday, actually, a couple of really great companies reported earnings and absolutely knocked it out of the park. And remember, earnings is a euphemism that I guess is much less offensive than its true meaning, profits. So these companies reported great profits, and those companies on Thursday night in succession just got the folks on CNBC in a tizzy. Amazon blew it out of the park. Alphabet, which is Google, blew it out of the park. And Microsoft blew it out of the park. They all beat Wall Street expectations by a very wide margin. And these were legitimate profits. I mean, profit derived from growing revenue. This wasn't accounting hijinks. It was all legitimate. But once again, we have to put this into perspective of reality versus illusion. Because of global central bank money printing, the profits these companies have earned are part of the grand illusion. Before I explain that, let me say that even under a gold standard or other means of limiting money supply, these three companies would probably be winners. But their gains would be coming at someone else's expense. Now, your stockbroker or financial planner probably told you that when the economy is growing, all stocks rise, but the better companies rise faster. That's not entirely true, or at least it's not complete. When money supply is growing, both GDP and the stock market rise together. They don't have to, but that's the way it usually works. So GDP doesn't cause the stock market to go up. Money supply does. Under a gold standard, neither GDP nor the stock market would go up much. In fact, the tendency would be for both of them to go down due to increases in productivity, at least over the long term. You'll see little bumps up, little bumps down, but the general trend would be down. So what does this have to do with Amazon, Google, and Microsoft? Well, newly printed money from the Fed and other central banks impacts financial fundamental variables in the aggregate. And I'm talking about fundamentals like revenue, profits, cash flow. For example, revenues and particularly profits rise and fall with the ebb and flow of money that's printed and the spending that arises from central bank money printing. When the government creates new money and inserts it into the economy, the new money increases the sales revenues of companies before it increases their costs. Okay, so revenues go up first, costs second. When sales revenues rise faster than costs, what do we call that? We call that profit margin. Specifically, we call it increasing profit margin. Revenues are going up faster than your costs. New money is spent first by firms that borrow and get loans. And by the way, that's how money's created. Their expenditures show up as new and additional sales revenues for other businesses, usually the borrower's vendors, the people that provide stuff to the business that took out the loan. But there is a time lag on many of the costs associated with the businesses of the recipients of this freshly printed money, primarily due to accounting rules and procedures, and that would include the spreading of asset costs across the useful life of the asset. We call that depreciation. Also, they can postpone the recognition of inventory costs until the product is actually sold. And we call that the cost of goods sold. And these practices are really the main two reasons why costs are lagged. And so on an income statement, also called the profit and loss statement, when these companies report their earnings or their profits, really what they're doing is reporting their income statements. So let me just summarize this. Revenues hit the books immediately after the money is created, but the recognition of costs are lagged. In fact, costs can be recognized by companies' income statements months or years after they're actually incurred. And this creates the illusion of high or higher profit. But that's not all. That's not the only reason why companies reporting their profits are a bit illusionary. And the other reason, the third and probably most important reason actually, is because of the money printing itself. Monetary values of costs are diminished by inflation by the time they're recognized. If there is a lag, then by the time you buy something and by the time you recognize it, inflation has eroded the true value of that cost. That also helps boost profit. For example, if a company recognizes $1 million in costs for equipment purchased in 2009, well, that $1 million is worth less today than in 2009. But on the income statement, the corresponding revenues recognized today are valued in terms of today's purchasing power. So let's unpack that a little bit. If I spend $1 million on a machine in 2009, That same machine today would probably cost $150,000 more just because of inflation, price inflation. So I want to show that cost on my income statement at the $1 million I paid, not the new inflated value, of course. And that was because of money printing. The new value is because of money printing. The old value is going to be relatively less. Money printing causes price inflation. Meanwhile, I recognize my revenues that I earn by selling, let's say, widgets at the new inflated value. Now I'm comparing revenues made with today's dollars against costs made with cheaper dollars, and that inflates my profit. Profits are revenues minus costs. So it should probably be mentioned here that this analysis only holds when money supply is growing. But have you seen a chart of money supply? It's always growing. So this is true almost always. This is the applicable analysis almost always. Another way of looking at it is that with more money being created through time, the amount of revenues is always greater than the amount of costs, since most of the costs are incurred when there is less money existing. Thus, because of inflation, the total monetary value of business costs in a given time frame is smaller than the total monetary value of the corresponding business revenues. Were there no inflation, costs would be much more closely aligned to revenues, even if that recognition were delayed. So under a gold standard, profits wouldn't be nearly as high as they are now because there would be no inflation. Costs could not be recognized when prices were low. Okay, so we'll talk about what the implications of that are, especially for investors, when we get back, but we do have to take a break. You're listening to Free Market Underground, all things boom and bust on KCMO Talk Radio 710 and 103.7 FM as well.
I'm going to Kansas City. Kansas City, here I come.
Welcome back to Free Market Underground, where every week we engage you in thoughtful discourse about our economy and our markets. My name is Chris Butler, and I'm a portfolio manager with Butler Lands and Wagler. And we're going to finish our conversation here about inflated profits in just a second. That is Fats.
That's Fats.
R.I.P. Rest in peace, Fats Domino.
Yes.
You know, Martell, I was actually a little shocked when I heard that he died, and I'm embarrassed to say this, but I thought he was already dead.
I don't think you're the only one, Chris.
Okay.
So don't be embarrassed by that.
Good. It shocked me. I really did not know. But
It's one of those things where you remember a guy when he dies.
Right.
We hadn't thought about him before, but when he dies, it's like, oh, yeah.
Yeah,
he
right.
He was pretty good.
He was great. Absolutely. In fact, on the news, local news, this week, they had a guy on that was telling the story of how that song, Kansas City, Going to Kansas City, was written, why it was written. And, you know, I didn't get a chance to hear the whole story, but he was going to Kansas City, and he was actually here when he wrote it.
Really?
Yeah. So
I would like to hear that story.
Yeah, I would too. I'd like to hear all of it in its entirety. I couldn't pay attention. I was doing something else. But rest in peace, Fats Domino.
Rest in peace. Lost a good one.
We did. And people in Kansas City have been using that song for any number of purposes for the better part of, what, 40 years, 50
yeah,
years?
Longer than that.
Yeah, 60, I guess, right?
The song came out in 1958.
Yeah, so 59 years, almost six decades of people using that song. Great song, though. Great performer. All right, back to our analysis of profits and why they, too, are a little bit on the illusion side. But I do want to state again, we were talking about in the last segment, some of the great earnings that came out, and which, by the way, is good for the economy overall, or a good sign, I should say, for the economy. But I guess it's good for the economy, too. Google, Amazon, Microsoft all reported blowout numbers, all had very high and legitimate profits. And we're talking really about how those numbers get inflated. And if I can summarize, money printing increases the spread between revenue and costs, and we call that a profit margin or profits. the tremendous amount of money that we created, and we created a ton of it in 2008 and 2009, that's what's responsible for the fantastic profits that companies are currently reporting. And not everybody is reporting great profits, but there are a number of them that are. Since business sales revenues increase before business costs, with every round of new money printed, business profit margins stay relatively wide, certainly wider than they would be under a gold standard. They also increase in line with an increased rate of inflation, and that's one reason why countries with high rates of inflation have such high rates of profit. It's also one of the reasons why these countries with high rates of inflation have outstanding stock market returns. But it means less. I think it was Venezuela, if I'm not mistaken, that had a year recently, or a 12-month period recently, where their stock market was up 80%. Was that Venezuela? Meanwhile, they were printing money like it was their job. I forget exactly if it was Venezuela or not. But that if you're going to print a bunch of money, you're going to create a bunch of inflation. And with that, you get asset price inflation. Stock markets go up. So the point is, during bad economic times, when the government doesn't print as much money, or at least they're not printing it as at a rate as high as it once was, profits tend to shrink. And during times of price deflation, prices going down, sales revenues fall faster than costs. And that creates a problem. Obviously, that means business losses. Okay, so what? Who cares? What does this have to do with investing? That's a good question. I'm glad you asked. It means that we adjust profits for money supply inflation, and we do that over a long time. And guess what it looks like? It looks like the stock market adjusted for money printing. There is no upward trend. There's no growth at all over time, pretty much what the case would be on a gold standard or a constant money supply. So using profits as a criterion for investment decisions is still valid if you're going to compare profits of a company versus another company in the same period, time period. But if you compare one company's profit growth and you expect that to be meaningful over a long period of time, you are probably looking at an illusionary time series data. It's okay to compare one company's profits versus another for third quarter 2017. But if you're looking at one company and you're saying, wow, look, they're profit growth has averaged 30% per year. Probably not. Not that that's meaningful, really. Most people are doing the analysis based on trying to determine which stock to buy now. Okay, so that's one reason why we need to pay attention to this. Second reason is, when you hear a company had a great quarter of profits, like we just did this week, you might want to see if there was a huge amount of money created over the past 5 to 10 years. Guess what? There has been. More than likely, if that's the case, if we saw a big bump in money printing, that's the source of some or all of their profits. The final point is this. Without money printing, some companies currently showing profits would be unprofitable. Others, of course, would still be profitable, but maybe less so than if we had a gold standard. Those companies truly leading in innovation and efficiency are going to be the ones that are leading the pack, whether we've got a gold standard or not. That means if we go into recession, by the way, I suspect many companies are going to show just how unprofitable they are. Some of those companies are going to go bankrupt. And it's going to be because the tide of money printing will have been reversed. I never get tired of saying this, but Warren Buffett's favorite saying, or one of his favorite sayings, is that you never know who's swimming naked until the tide rolls out. Well, the tide rolls out when we stop printing as much money. And then you actually get to see how much of a company's profits were due to money printing and how much were not due to money printing. And that's what we need to be fearful of. We need to be fearful of the fact that we're getting fooled by some companies. And again, I want to stress that the three companies that knocked it out of the ballpark on Thursday night, all great companies, relatively speaking, they probably are some of the strongest companies in the United States. Now, interestingly, Amazon.com has been pushing off profits for a long time as they try to grow organically and take losses, if they have to, at least accounting losses, to build their market share. So the fact that they have profits is kind of new, or I should say the fact that they have blowout profits is kind of new. But all things considered, these are three relatively good companies. So don't think I am picking on them. I'm not. One last bit on that analysis, which is that money printing drives up revenues faster and quicker than costs, which gives us an inflated sense of profitability. One last bit on that. Price inflation is necessary to support an overly indebted corporate sector, an overly indebted public sector, and an overly indebted household sector. If prices actually were allowed to go down, in other words, if we stopped printing money, our incomes would go down, but our debt levels, measured in dollars, would remain the same. And you can imagine that potential nightmare. And that's a big reason why money printing is always going on. Chew on this for just a moment. Money gets created simultaneously with debt. In fact, if you go to a bank and you get a loan, the loan proceeds are printed out of thin air and put into your checking account, and you've created a debt for yourself. Money printing creates debt. They are created simultaneously. So the point is this: if we must keep printing money so that debt doesn't overwhelm every sector of the economy, we've got a problem. By creating more money, we have to create more debt. Okay, but we're printing money so that the debt becomes less meaningful. Can you think of a more stupid, self-imposed system than that? It makes absolutely no sense. But that's what we're in. That's the system that we have. And the risk of that system is that you actually don't get any money created. And keep this in mind, that there needs to be demand for money for there to be supply. Okay, so when you actually see money printing go down, it's generally because banks are not creating as many loans as they were. And that could be because the bank itself doesn't want to supply any because it's fearful of getting paid that money back. Or it could be because fewer people actually think taking on more debt is a good idea. So when the economy slows down, when you look at a recession, what you're really seeing is people saying to the banker, I don't want that loan. Now, later in the recession, it's the bank that says, I don't want to make the loan. Okay, so in a sense, money supply deflation is more dependent on me and you than it is the bank or the Federal Reserve. Federal Reserve can do a lot of things like quantitative easing, and that might spur inflation. That's why they did it, because they knew people, well, actually, they knew both people didn't want loans and banks didn't want to make them. Okay, so the point is this. To a certain extent, anyway, some of the risk is that people suddenly realize they don't want any more debt, because then you get the deflation and then you get people trapped with this constant level of debt, but with their incomes going down. That's the problem. And it's a problem that is self-imposed, by the way. We need to take a break right now. When we get back, we will continue talking about the economy and the markets. You're listening to Free Market Underground on KCMO Talk Radio 710, now heard on 103.7 FM as well. More about. Oh, do I have to talk now? Welcome back to Free Market Underground, all things boom and bust. Where every week we try to make a little bit of sense out of our world. My name is Chris Butler, portfolio manager with Butler Lands and Wagler. And just talking about how money printing distorts profits. I guess you could call that the theme of today, or you could call the theme of today how far our tax system has been distorted. By the way, I do want to mention a couple things before we finish the show. Number one, look for Free Market Underground on Facebook Live. That content, and I'm not sure exactly when it'll be released, I think Monday. I'm not sure exactly what the schedule will be, but one will come out on Monday. Look for Free Market Underground on Facebook Live. Check out that page. And then if you can, check out that broadcast live on Facebook Live. Secondly, I also want to talk a little bit, if I can, about that the tax system that we have. In no way would I suggest to you that we should not have a way of funding government. I just think the income tax is one of the stupidest things we've ever done. I am much more amenable to a national sales tax, what they call the fair tax. And the basic rationale is this. If we believe in the price system, what we know is that what people make in terms of income or wages is roughly how the market values the product of their labor. Okay, so the people that make a lot of income are providing, or at least the market thinks they are providing a significant amount of value. And usually when I say that, people think, oh, football players don't deserve million. Well, actually they do, because people watch football. Baseball players, they make what they do because people watch. They demand baseball. They demand professional baseball. I mean, you could make whatever societal commentary you want on that. And teachers, first of all, teachers are always brought up as not making what they deserve. Yes, they do. First of all, they probably make more than you think they do if you just look at the fact that they work less than a full year, number one. Number two, I think my own value scale, I put a lot of value on teachers, but not everyone does. And that's because not a lot of people put a value on education, or at least not on the education they perceive that their children will get. So it's all subjective value that determines income. So why on earth would you take somebody that provides society with the most value and tell them that they are going to pay more? They will be penalized more than the next guy because they provide more value. Something that always gets lost in that conversation about taxes is that business owners already provide value. They don't have to pay taxes to provide value. They're putting goods on the market. And if you think that's not worth a lot, spend a week in Venezuela. Of course it's valuable. We wake up every morning. If we want to get a loaf of bread, we know exactly where to get it, and they will not be out. Now, they might not have the brand we prefer, but they've got bread every day, rain and shine. So, a national sales tax, I think, is a more amenable, and you can also get rid of the whole class envy thing. You can get rid of our caste system that the income tax forces upon us. It is more, in my opinion, it is more moral and ethical to do it that way than by penalizing the most productive, the most valuable services out there. That's just my take on it. Let's talk about the economy. The leading economic indicators did actually take a breather this week, but what a vicious rise in that index over the past 4, 5, 6 weeks. We have now fully recaptured all of the recent weakness that started in April, and we are powering higher. That bodes well for economic productivity in the future. This week, if you look at markets, do you know what was driving everything? Well, not everything. A good part of the story. If you're going to tell a story about markets in the last week, you would start and maybe even end with yields. It is now all about interest rates. Since September, because of this, banks have outperformed the general market. Interest rate sensitive securities like REITs, for example, don't like rising rates. Bonds don't like rising rates. Since September 8th, interest rates on the 10-year Treasury, so what is that, about almost a month and a half, Treasuries, the interest rate on 10-year Treasuries are up 20% in that time. 20%, quite a rise. That actually is one of the reasons why the market had such a bad day on Wednesday. It was totally freaked out by the huge jump in interest rates. GDP, we got our first view of the latest quarter of GDP, and I it's too soon. I didn't read anything about it, but it was a good number. It was 3% versus 3.1% last quarter. I'm not sure when the last time we had two 3% quarters in a row. I'm not sure when that was. Now, here's the thing about that number. Don't get too excited about it. It's probably benefiting from inventories, which we built up, and they're probably going to be drawn down next quarter, and that will hurt GDP as much as the inventory build helped GDP in this quarter. More than likely, that's going to happen. Still, this number, I don't want to in any way diminish what this number is or means. It was strong across the board. The only weakness was in new residential fixed investment, and that means home building or apartment building. That looks like it's going to turn around over the next few quarters because we had a blowout number in new home sales last month, September, to the tune of about 20%, a 20% jump in a month. That is a volatile number, and you can't really trust it until you get a lot more data, a bigger sample size. But a lot of those home sales, we're told, were done on spec. In other words, they're yet to be built. And if you're telling a story about the markets last week, you also have to make mention of tech stocks. On Friday, the NASDAQ was up over 1.5% at one point. That is some strong stuff. There are all of the usual worries. All of the usual worries are out there. Stocks are overvalued. People have pretty much gone all in on stocks, and that makes for a risky environment. In fact, if you were to invest at these levels, depending on which valuation metric you're using, your returns are not likely to be very good over the next 10 years. But the fear gauge is not very worrisome right now. Anything that would suggest that stocks are overvalued, yes, that is still present. So what you don't have to consider what worries me, but here's what worries me. We spent a lot of time today talking about how money printing distorts corporate fundamentals. The U.S. stock market has benefited more than most developed market stock markets from a concerted global central bank money printing tsunami. But I'll remind you every week if I can that that's going to end, and it's going to end soon. After injecting the equivalent of $2 trillion U.S. dollars over the last 12 months, the 12-month inflow will be hitting roughly zero in the year 2018, if central banks stick to their stated plans. And by the way, this week we learned the European Central Bank will be tapering their QE. So what's the trigger that'll start it all? I don't know, but we need to watch interest rates. I know that. Stay tuned for Don Wales, Protecting Your Retirement. That comes up next. Thanks for listening to Free Market Underground.